I think taking a historian's perspective is a very valuable one, because at any moment in human history, what is striking to me is how much progress was yet to be made. There's a movie called Bullet. I don't know if you've seen it. In my home city of San Francisco, Steve McQueen drives around at very high speeds in the 1960s. What a lot of people don't know about that movie is that they filmed it in real life. They went to San Francisco General Hospital. Go watch it sometime and look at what a hospital looked like in the 1960s and think about what's not there. There's no ultrasound. The surgical ward looks medieval. The emergency room is a bunch of bandages and some painkillers. So I ask my students, has anyone here ever heard of exploratory surgery? Some of you have and some of you haven't, and it follows generational lines. Exploratory surgery used to be very popular before we could just do these ultrasounds and see exactly what's going on. It was medieval, but in those days, it was all quite modern. That sense of what we haven't discovered is hard to grasp, but that is really critical. That's the central opportunity here. And I think part of the great opportunity of the FS Insight platform is that it's going to enable us to identify the areas where we need to work to achieve the kind of progress we need to achieve to make the future as good as it can potentially be. There we go. So I call my talk Three Challenges in Sustainable Finance. These are three problems that I think we need to get right, three areas where I think we need to make significant progress to have a fruitful outcome. Before I talk specifically about those, though, I thought it would be beneficial to maybe raise the prospect of who are the leaders today. This website, this platform represents, I think it's fair to say, an ambition on the part of the Netherlands to be a global leader in the field of sustainable finance. And you may not realize the degree to which that's already been achieved. I preside in various degrees over the Moskowitz Prize. Moskowitz Prize is an independent prize currently adopted by the University of California at Berkeley after it outgrew its status as a hobby. We've awarded it each year for the best study, the best quantitative empirical study of social investment, and we've been doing that since 1996. We've got great judges. It's an all-volunteer effort. The secret to success is to get great people and convince them to work for free. And so the prize, I'm having a little trouble advancing this.
I think page down or?
Yeah, not working for some reason.
Oh.
The prize, we've given in the past 10 years 10 Moskowitz Prizes. If you look at the geographical distribution of those, three have been won by the Dutch. That is by teams based in the Netherlands. And so I think that's one basis of pride. Seven out of 10 were won by the rest of the world, but that's still a very good showing. And I'll show you a graph. I thought that was actually, given that we're a Dutch audience, I thought that is actually a bit unfair. So what I did was I calculated it per capita. Per capita, the Netherlands stands at the top of the World League tables in terms of Moskowitz Prizes won. So this is a really outstanding group of people in the Netherlands. Some of the strongest researchers in the world work here, and we have no dog in this fight at the Moskowitz Prize. We award the prize to the study we think is best, and they come in from everywhere. I don't know who the ringleaders are exactly. I think Kees Kodijk is involved in some way. I think that probably Rob Bauer has something to do with it, but I haven't been able to identify the ringleaders with any certainty. So as we look at the sustainable finance movement and the efforts we're making as we go forward, the three challenges that we're hoping that this website will help address are, number one, governance. Number two, sustainability, and I'll have more to say from what Mark said. And number three, this problem of overconfidence. Overconfidence is real, and it's probably the greatest obstacle to progress. And I think, again, the historian's perspective is probably valuable there, and I think hopefully that's something we can talk about afterward.
Yeah.
From the perspective of governance, it would be nice for me to start right in and talk about how we can bring market-based solutions to the world of governance or to the world of sustainability. But governance gets in the way. I was asked in preparing these remarks to give you a practitioner's perspective. The most valuable practitioner's perspective I can actually give you is from my experience of the late 1990s. I worked as an analyst for a growth firm in San Francisco. And over the course of 5 years, I probably did in-depth work on about 100 companies. And so I was counting last night. Of those 100 companies that I studied over that five-year period, 7 had executives who went to prison. Okay, now that was a wild time. That was a terrible deterioration in the quality of corporate governance. But that was the real working environment. Now, I came from the Peter Lynch generation of analysts who believed that, you know, you look at 20 companies, you look at 10 companies, maybe you're going to find one good idea. And what Peter Lynch didn't tell us is you're going to find one idea and one outright fraud. Okay? You're going to find one guy in a striped prison uniform. So we brought in Sarbanes-Oxley to address that. That's why that legislation was so important in the United States. And here's the chart, if we can go down.
Yeah.
Yep, down one. There we go. This is the crucial chart of the whole presentation. That's why I'm up. Nope. You'll never see it. I'm sorry. But it absolutely proves the superiority of the Netherlands, so I hope that motivates you guys to bring it up. So the problem we have, though, with governance is that Sarbanes-Oxley did not solve this issue of misrepresentation. And the problem is if they're lying to us about the numbers on the financial statements, if they're lying to us about the financial condition of the company, then how can we expect them to be receptive to outside influence with respect to sustainability or for that matter, social?
We got it.
All right. Per capita, Moskowitz Prize victories. California is about here, though, so watch out. If we ever declare our independence, we're gonna be after you. So. That was the only important slide in the presentation.
Zet hem maar niet op presentatiemode.
It's okay. It's fine. I can speak extemporaneously. So in governance, here's the problem. After we passed Sarbanes-Oxley, we had immediately, almost within 2 or 3 years, according to Warren Buffett, the two largest accounting misstatements in history, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, as well as the Lehman Brothers debacle, and the AIG, of course. Let me start first with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac had a dedicated regulator. There was one government regulatory agency that was assigned only to the regulation of those two companies, OFAIL. And Warren Buffett says they would come out every year and they'd say the directors are fine and the finances are fine and the companies are fine. And then we had the greatest accounting misstatement in history. So what happened? What happened, I believe, was regulatory capture, where the regulated ultimately gain so much influence with the regulator that they effectively control the regulator, that they effectively control the dynamic, and the regulator becomes subsumed to the goals and objectives of the people controlling the enterprise. And in this case, it was catastrophic. Regulatory capture is not well understood, but I know one thing. There's no invisible hand that's going to fix it for you. It has to be fixed through affirmative policy initiatives. John Taylor at Stanford University, better known for the Taylor Rule, has written a couple of notes on this. And I think this is an area where active investigation will be very fruitful, and hopefully it's one of the things that we can bring to FS Insight in the years to come. But even if we get basic governance right, we're still not out of the woods because there's another problem, and this is what happened at Lehman, and that's jurisdictional arbitrage. At Lehman, they had a little problem. They wanted to run the company at a higher degree of leverage than the market really wanted them to run at. So they would print their balance sheet, and then the day after the balance sheet, they would go raise their leverage. They wanted to do this through a repurchase agreement that would move the money off the balance sheet and onto the income statement, but that's illegal in America. You can't do it. But it's legal in England. So they did it in England. And they did it through Repo 105. And If you're ever feeling cheerful and want to depress yourself, go read the examiner's report on Repo 105. It was an extraordinarily complex transaction. The global controller of Lehman said it had no effective economic purpose. It was purely window dressing. They have emails from Lehman executives saying, are other Wall Street firms doing this? Is it just window dressing? Can we get away with it? And the answers to those were, no one else is doing it, and yes, it's just window dressing, and yeah, we think we can get away with it. We're wrong on that last one. So we have to get governance right, and those are two major problems, regulatory capture and jurisdictional arbitrage. The only solution that I can see is some type of global standard for governance. And ultimately, capital markets are going to have to play a much larger role in governance than they currently do. We've been through a 15-year episode of a severe deterioration in corporate governance, and we need to reverse that before, I believe, we can plausibly talk about making significant improvements in corporate behavior with respect to the environment and sustainability, which we need to do. Mark's point is well taken, that these are not things that we could just leave off. Global climate change is gradual but inexorable. The things we're doing, we've not modified our behavior in a significant way yet, so we are already living with a degree of global warming we probably would not have to live with had we been more proactive 10 or 15 years ago. The other insidious thing about sustainability and global climate change is that, in a funny way, does anyone feel warm today? Did you feel warm coming in? No, it's cold here. I grew up in Alaska. Global warming, it's evident. If you talk to the Eskimo, to the Native Americans up there, they've noticed it's gotten warmer because the food tastes different and the wildlife is having different patterns. But it's tough when you just wake up in the morning and it's freezing outside to worry about global warming. The place where they're feeling global climate change right now is emerging Asia, China, and India. If you look at global water availability per capita, it's already at close to crisis levels in both of those countries. There's a report this morning out of Hong Kong on my desk that says that the shortages of water in China are already affecting wheat production. Okay? China's already feeding 22% of the world's people on 9% of its arable land. They don't have a lot of margin here. In 2000, they were oil self-sufficient. Now they're importing half of their oil. They're burning an enormous amount of coal. These are the effects of global climate change and the consequences of global neglect of sustainability issues will be felt first in emerging Asia, where they have the fewest resources to deal with it. There's no single government policy that can address these things, but, as Mark points out, market solutions could be very fruitful. At our firm, we've started an emerging markets strategy which is intended to direct capital towards solutions that will be beneficial in emerging markets, and I hope a dozen other firms do that. Because right now, we have ESG funds in the G20 and virtually nothing in emerging Asia. But emerging Asia is where all the problems will be encountered first and where a lot of the new money and new wealth is being generated. The third thing I want to mention is overconfidence. Everyone here, this looks like a pretty bright group of people, fairly accomplished group of people. You can correct me if I'm wrong about that, but you look sharp. Overconfidence is a pernicious and scary thing. And if you've worked in the investment world, as I understand many of you have, you know that overconfidence is actually one of your primary occupational risks. I have a colleague who works for a hedge fund, and he's unusual because he's been working for the same fund and following the same strategy for about 20 years, and he hasn't blown up. And he says, arrogance is death. But many highly intelligent, highly educated people underappreciate the magnitude of their own ignorance. Being extremely well-educated and extremely knowledgeable relative to your community, even relative to a group of very bright people, and the top people at good Wall Street firms, good money management firms, we're not talking about the top 1%, we're talking 0.1 or 0.01%. They're very, very bright people who did well in every course they ever took. They didn't just impress their teachers, they dazzled them. And it's very difficult for them to then hear, your understanding of the world is incomplete. The models you use are not a thorough and clear description of what's really happening. Despite your enormous wealth and financial success and learning and ability to articulate the aspects of your business, you may be overconfident. Overconfidence, we know from the behavioral economists, correlates with intelligence. Okay? Someone who's had an average record in school and an average record in employment is unlikely, although it happens, to have a really high view of themselves, to overestimate their capability because they get so much feedback. But someone who's been told their whole lives how brilliant they are may overshoot. It correlates with the complexity of the problem, and whatever we say about the problems we're trying to solve in sustainable finance, we can say with absolute certainty they are not simple. One set of solutions is very unlikely. One discipline, be it economics, finance, environmental, ecological science, one discipline will not be adequate to meet the challenges that we've described here today. Therefore, we will need a platform, some way of crossing the intellectual barriers. In business schools today, we tend to silo out the learning. My students typically get one worldview from the finance professor, one from the ethics professor, one from the socially responsible investment professor, one from the marketing professor. And then they just leave it to the students. You figure it out. That's not really acceptable. Ultimately, just because we're masters of one art, one trade, one remarkable body of knowledge, it's not enough. We have to communicate and we have to learn from one another because staying in our disciplines is not working. I think that we have abundant evidence of that now, from the global financial crisis to what we're seeing with global climate change. There's a large intermediate space between policy and finance. Some say it's politics, but I think there's more there. There's culture, there's civics, and frankly, there's the engaged, informed conversation of people across intellectual boundaries. FS Insight will facilitate that, and it will do so in a global fashion, so that not only can we talk with our colleagues at Tilburg, talk with our colleagues at Maastricht and in Singapore, hopefully we can also talk with our colleagues in China and Brazil. And if we do the good new thinking and the innovation that's required and come forward with solutions and ideas that hopefully can synthesize different schools of thought and find steps forward that will take us into a more productive future, we can share them. This is the first time we've had a global platform for that, and I'm very honored and proud to be a part of it. Thank you very much.